wonderful Miss Rebecca Wolf, who is a poet of great renown, editrix of Fence. What else do you want me to say about all that? I'm just psyched that we're starting a new religion of our very own. It's called the Benevolent Society of Sensory Integrationists. So anyone who wants to join up, let us know. Love and Rebecca.
Are a 15-year-old girl named Ginger and her best friend Cherry, although Cherry really is invisible through most of what I'm going to read. And then there is a couple who moves to this very, very, very small, very isolated town in Massachusetts in which they have spent their entire lives. And I'm going to read from the very first chapter and then delve into the middle of the book, and I'll just set that up when I get to it. Thanks, Alan. Late May. I was standing there in my usual spot behind the counter at the Top Hat Cafe, looking down, thinking about evil, buttering toast. Last night I dreamt about the 4th of July. Perhaps that will be the day that I die. This year? If not this year, then maybe the next, or maybe in 42 years. I should say the narrator is the 15-year-old girl named Ginger. That helps you to know that. I gauge my reaction to the news of my impending death on a day when fireworks are the only identifiable landmark for miles around, when you picture a black night sky and small similes of stars against it from the perspective of a craned neck and an open mouth, soundlessly ooing and aahing. I can see it all so clearly. I am 15 years old. I like to scare myself. But I don't know that it is myself. The worst dream I ever had involved a house and a field. I was outside the house under a big sky. It was all in technicolor blues and greens. I had gone to this house to help save my best friend, a sort of grinning scarecrow figure, from persecution. He was accused of having committed a murder with an axe. The body of the dream consisted of the straw man chasing me over rutted roads and into a field, finally catching up with me where I was halted at a tall wooden electrified fence. All this under a wide, solidly blue sky. At the fence, my friend revealed to me through his toothy grin a truism. "Your best friend is your worst enemy," he said, and then proceeded to outline the punishment I was to endure for my crime. With nothing in sight except the brilliant sky at all edges of the horizon, my horribly smiling friend tells me that I am to begin eating myself alive immediately, starting with the tips of the fingers of my right hand, and that no sooner will I finish eating myself than my innards will be all outside, and I will be turned inside out, and I must then begin all over again and eat until I am outside in again, and then begin again, ad infinitum or ad nauseum. But this, even, is not the full brunt of the punishment. This is just the flesh of the sentence. The skeleton, when revealed to me, is what terrifies me most, what causes me to wake up in a state of such white-hot horror and disgust that I can still recall it, although I dreamed this dream when I was barely more than a child. Is there a little feedback going on?
Yeah, a little bit.
Should I just step back? Is that better? Your sentence, the scarecrow says to me, is to enact over and over the contents of the worst nightmare I ever had. Me, your best friend. Now I will stand here and watch you eat yourself as I have seen it only in my dreams heretofore. Forever after, you will be the subject of this nightmare, not me. Is it evil, I wonder, as I stack the toast, cut it into halves, and arrange the halves on a small plate, to act consistently with one's wishes, even though one knows that among the consequences of these actions is pain and sorrow for those around one? Or is it evil to wish for things that will cause pain and sorrow? Or are these the same thing? Or is it evil? Does evil contain? Is evil bigger than any one person's actions or thoughts or wishes? Evil as a floating contingency of being, like a hat that lands on one's head? If that were so, then it would seem to exonerate one from any kind of personal responsibility. That first day in the cafe, I am amazed that I did not notice their entrance, the Motherwells, Raquel and Theo, a good-looking young couple. I was ringing up a check at the register when I heard a distinctive voice, rich and low, cutting through the general hum. Theo, this toast is as dry as a witch's tit. And then laughter that was at once nervous and uncontrolled, like that of a child awake past her bedtime, running on the energy of a new hour. I looked up in the direction of the one table in the window, which at certain times of day is too bright with sun, and saw her there with a man, or tall boy maybe. Theo is younger than she, slender, though strong. His feathery hair was an ashy, dirty blonde, and he wore loose shorts made of a fabric woven in Guatemala or some other far-off land, and tennis shoes and a t-shirt. He seemed at ease in our homely setting. They had a newspaper. It did not look to be the Valley Republican. On the table between them, and some plates of eggs with bright orange yolks, as yet unbroken, and toast and coffee. That might have been the very toast I had buttered, preoccupied as I was. Danielle, the other girl, had served them invisibly. At 15, I still possessed a child's native capacity for belief. Some call it naivete, but I prefer to think of it as a positive attribute, a capability, and enjoyed a commensurate appetite for phenomena in which to believe. Another appetite that diminishes as we mature. Already now, telling this story, though I have not yet achieved majority, and there's a mosquito on my nose, the weight of adult accountability descends, and I assent to the banality of truth, to the scale's discernible tipping on the side of whatever is the simplest explanation. The simplest explanation for any phenomenon is usually the correct one. The correct explanation is the simplest one. A ghost is a draft of cold air on the skin, a neuron-fueled shape in the dark hour of sleep. A mind reader is, at best, someone who pays closer attention to detail than most, who is wide open to suggestion. At worst, she is a con artist. A witch is a woman with an enemy or two. Is this simple enough to sustain us? I ask you. Raquel told me one day when almost everything had already happened, when I had looked at her face so often I could hardly even see it anymore, that someone had once told her that she had a muddy brown aura, a chance encounter with a psychic healer from Copenhagen in a bar in Lisbon. The woman clasped Raquel's becalmed face in her smooth hands, then gently released it as though to send her away, to push her off like a little boat from the shore. And when Raquel told me this, she laughed, but I could see the brown webbing falling over her, restricting the motion of her jaw, her mouth filling with the dusty stuff. I left the cafe that day at 6:30, as usual, after giving the counter and tables a final wipe down and separating the bills in the register into rubber-banded denominations, then stashing them in the little safe in the stockroom, switching off the lights, and locking first the front door from inside, then the back door behind me. I could indeed be trusted. My bike was where I'd left it, where I'd always left it, propped against the fence by the trash cans, lids ajar, fat orphans wanting gruel. As I rode home, I thought about the newcomers. As far as I could remember, no one had ever moved to WIC. But was that possible? I suppose some had moved away and then scurried back. My own father, for example, before Jack's birth. But that didn't really count. That was like a trick question on a first grader's math quiz. What's 2 + 2 - 2? Did this mean that I had never before met anybody I hadn't known my whole life? I guessed so, unless you counted newborn natives who came bawling to the town and were duly presented in their swaddling clothes. These were my first adults. And so, time passes in the novel. And Ginger and her best friend Cherry spend an increasing amount of time with these two mysterious adults, the Motherwells, and it sort of advances rapidly into a unsavory connection. And so, but this is before it gets really unsavory. Chapter 15. No one answered my knock at the Motherwells, so I just went in. The living room was empty. I went to the kitchen, expecting to find Raquel, but found no one. A plate of crumbs, Raquel knew how to make toast, sat on the round table, aside from which there was no sign that anyone had been there in the last decade. I went down the hall and put my foot cautiously on the first step of the staircase. I couldn't decide if I ought to be very, very quiet, as was my wont, or instead do the unexpected, announce myself. Aside from in conversation and the occasional meal, Raquel and Theo seemed to spend most of their time catching up on sleep. When had they missed all these hours? And sure enough, as I ascended to the landing, I saw that they lay curled up together on the pallet in Theo's study, a book splayed, cracked wide open, its spine broken, on the floor next to them. They did not move at all as I continued up the stairs and then stood in the doorway for a moment, and this seemed odd. I focused my attention minutely on the movements of their chests, on their breath. I did not believe that they were really asleep. Did I spy the shallow rhythm of a feigned unconsciousness? Had they set me a trap of some sort? Nevertheless, after standing there for a few moments, I found, to my surprise, that I felt quite drowsy, a paralyzed, lids propped open, already asleep kind of drowsy. The door to their bedroom was half open, and a cozy glow from the bedside lamp illuminated the tangle of blankets and sheets on their bed. As I approached, I saw that a small book with gilt-edged pages lay open on Raquel's pillow, where I might lay my head, and I sat down on the edge of the bed and picked it up. As soon as I came to a total comprehension of what I saw, the scratchy handwriting, the dated entries, I put it down again, like it was a hot pan and I without a potholder. Then I thought of them lying quietly, sleeping, or silently, though pointedly caressing one another, or simply waiting in the next room, and knew that it was desirable that I should read what lay on the pillow. The diary began at the time of their arrival in WIC, and had been kept with extreme inconsistency thereafter. May 13th. Theo has instructed me to keep this diary, a journal of our stolen year here together, and so I will do what I can with what I have, this perfect tool, a pen, this ideal receptacle with its little lock and key. If he were my flesh and blood, he could not know me any better. Does he want to know me better? June 7th. I'm not sure that I have the courage to go on. All these people seem to trust me. Oh, people, people, so sweet and stupid. If I had a heart to break. Note, possible country song lyric. July 28th. My question remains, why do people bother to write legibly in their diaries? For that matter, why do they write in English or Spanish, French, Polish, whatever blasted language? Why do we not invent new languages, or at least codes that only we can decode? I suppose Michelangelo did, or was that Da Vinci? I muse, mutter, ponder to myself, getting quite into the spirit of the thing. And that was today's entry. I thought that I had never read anything so sad. The ink was still a little shiny. If I touched it with my finger, as I was tempted to do, I would smear it. She must have just been lying in bed, struggling to do what had been asked of her, moments before I entered the house. And then what? She had prepared the room as she wanted me to see it, and slipped into Theo's study, where he sat working, or meditating, or whatever it was he did when he was not by Raquel's side, and coaxed him down onto the small guest bed. In their bedroom, just on the other side of the wall, I replaced the diary, open, on Raquel's pillow and lay down facing it on my side with my head on Theo's pillow. The pillowcase smelled faintly of hay. I reached behind me and groped for the lamp. I didn't plan that. I woke to the click of the switch, the spread of light, and Raquel's softest voice saying, "Wake up, sleepyhead, I want to show you something." Something else, I thought dreamily, and I dragged myself out of a swamp of sleep and muscled up to sitting. There she was with what looked like an old hatbox in her hands. She placed it on the bed and sat down next to it at my feet, then removed the cover to reveal a pile of photographs, perhaps 50 of them, some edged in crimped white borders, some with no borders and missing their corners as though they had been torn out of old albums. Some looked antique. Their surfaces were dull and the images were watery and uniformly brownish, the brown of a horse's coat. I meant to set this up, that Raquel and Theo give Ginger and Cherry a number of reasons why they have moved to this town and or what they're doing there, essentially. And the first reason that they give is that Raquel is working on her graduate dissertation and that it involves an autobiographical sort of quest for family members of hers who have moved to the town after the Salem witch trials, after their relative was hung for a witch in the Salem witch trials, and that they've moved to the town. Raquel and Theo have moved to the town because Raquel is going to do sort of a research project for her dissertation. Here's what I wanted to show you, this house. The photograph she held out to me was very old indeed and featured a family, a group of about 10 people in front of a large white edifice, all posed stiffly, some standing and some sitting on straight chairs, in the manner of the earliest portraits, for which the slightest gesture or error of informality would ruin an afternoon's effort. The house looked familiar. It was square, and the dark, possibly black trim around its windows gave it a distinctly unwelcoming air, seeming to suggest that a potential visitor might be better off out of doors, where the rigors of mortality held less sway. Their starched black dresses and suits, they were all in mourning, and careful hairdressings looked to be of an era a century before. Their faces had been scratched out, and this struck me as both unfortunate and appropriate. Whatever gathering or event this group portrait was meant to memorialize might have been better left unrecorded. "Do you see?" Raquel said excitedly, though she kept her voice low. "These are the descendants of the Goods who came here after the trials in Salem. Here they stayed, and this is the house they lived in, and this is a picture of them the day after their youngest daughter, she was only 18, I believe, at the time of her death, was executed for a crime she didn't commit, or at least not intentionally. The family legend has it that she and another girl were out swimming in the Shift River, and Emily Good was fooling around, showing her friend how her ancestors had been tested for the presence of witchcraft. And she was holding her under the water just for a minute, but then the girl struggled and her head hit a rock and the girl died. No one was sure whether she died of the blow to her head or of water in her lungs. But Emily Good was convicted of her murder and was hung, even though she was well along in her pregnancy. And the family never forgave the town for this unyielding punishment, and always wore black, and did not consort with the townspeople, and kept to themselves. This is Jacob Good, her brother. She pointed out a tall, slender, faceless man with a round hat like a Quaker's. The two were thick as thieves, separated only in death, and some say not even then. He was in training to be a minister, but on her execution day he renounced his faith. He never entered a church again. But although the Good family removed itself from the goings-on of the town, they did not remove themselves from the town itself, as they had done before when faced with an injustice of this magnitude. They would not be forced out again from the place they had called home for nearly two centuries. And even much later, 100 years later, when the towns were to be flooded to make the reservoir, the few remaining members of the family refused to evacuate their property. The officials, of course, tried to move them, but they were immovable. They just stayed where they were, even as the waters rose, and they were drowned in their home. In this house you see here, I suppose it was a final injustice, and they were ready for it. I looked again at the photograph and seemed to see the resolve imminent in their postures, their upright bearing, the poise of their hands. They were ready at that moment to die. But enough of these dusty relics. Let's go down to the water and I'll show you proof. Raquel's eyes were shining with certainty and engagement, and I thought, ah, so this is it. This is what she came here for, proof. And I am to be her witness, her accomplice too. We tiptoed past the room where Theo slept, down the stairs, out the door, and down the driveway to Raquel's car. Before I knew it, we were headed toward the loop road and around it in the deep of evening to an access road I had never noticed before, one about a quarter of the way around the circumference of the reservoir, clockwise, from Wick. This was where the town called Hammerstead lay, deep under the water. The remaining two lost towns of Shadley and Morrow, just to form their names with the mouth of my mind, made me shiver. Did they still answer to those silent names now that their borders were erased, their topographies washed away, their skies filled with black water? To say the names brought back all the inhabitants, the lives, and planted them there again, lost lives with eyes peering up hopelessly from the bottom of the darkest day anyone should ever see. Come out here, it's not cold, it's like bathwater, actually. Raquel stood knee-deep, her shorts rolled up high around her thighs. I did not remember getting out of the car or trekking down the little path to the water's edge, but here we were, and there she was. It must have been about 10 o'clock already. The sky had turned a violent blue, and the trees around the circumference of the water wore the black outlines that would soon spread and merge to make pitch blackness. You have to come out here to see. I made my way slowly in. It was indeed warm, unreasonably so. I had never felt it like this before. It was almost hot. It made me want to feel it all over me, unmediated, and so I waded back to the shore and stripped down, leaving my t-shirt and shorts in a pile, and then into the water, out to where Raquel stood, arms crossed under her breasts, regarding me. That's good, Ginger. It will be much easier to see when you are naked. I didn't question her logic. I knew only that the dark water against my skin felt like a giant mother's hand. And Raquel's hand was on my shoulder. We were chest deep in the water now, and so she didn't have far to go to place her other hand heavily on my other shoulder, a grip more than a placement, and use the full weight of her body, buoyant in the water, to land on me, behind me, and push me under, and hold me there. What did I see there, under the water? I awoke, unbreathing, in the midst of an unsuccessful gasp, with my face pressed up against the little book with the gilt-edged pages. My throat was closed, my mouth was dry, my eyes were sandy. I sat up and filled my lungs, rubbed my hands over my eyes. In the Motherwell's bathroom, I splashed my face and dried it on a red towel. A faint tracing of Raquel's fresh entry was printed on my damp temple. The lock had made an impression on my cheek. I moved quietly out into the hallway, then slipped past the room where they still slept, or were silent, down the stairs and out the door. I went to go find Cherry. Thank you.